Welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Gary Carnevale. Mary and Michaela have the night off. Thank you for listening tonight. Frameline 40, San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival, kicked off Thursday night and runs through next Sunday with over 300 features, documentaries, and short films. Tonight we'll have a conversation with Tuck Watkins, the star of Retake, Bob Hawke, the subject of the documentary Film Hawk, and Shalice Haas, the director of Real Boy. It's been a very difficult week for our community, and we here at Outbeat Radio hope you are healing. Many vigils and gatherings have happened to help us honor those killed and hurt in Orlando. I suspect more will occur, so please look at outbeatradio.com and gaysonoma.com for more events. Remember, you are not alone, so please, if you find yourself needing support, reach out to one of the many organizations listed on those sites. We'll continue the show right after Greg Moralia and Outbeat Radio News.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, June 19th, 2016. Tonight, our community, our country, and the world is still reeling from the horrific shooting that took place just 1 week ago at the Pulse Dance Club in Orlando, Florida. Tonight, we'd like to share with you the most important names of this story, those who lost their lives to hate. Here's Anderson Cooper with a story about each one.
We begin tonight with their names, the names of the 48 out of 49 people who have so far been identified, victims of the deadliest mass shooting in American history, a massacre that happened in a gay nightclub just a block from where I'm standing, just down that road, two nights ago. And we're going to start tonight by honoring them. There are more than a list of names. There are people who loved and were loved. There are people who had families and friends and dreams. And the truth is, we don't know much about some of them. We want you to hear their names and a little bit about who they were. Edward Sotomayor, Jr. He worked at a travel agency that catered to the gay community. His family says he was witty, charming, and that he always left things better than he found them. He was 34 years old. Stanley Almodovar III. He was a pharmacy technician. He was the last video that we saw of him. It was posted on social media. It showed him laughing and singing on the way to that nightclub. He was just 23. Luis Omar Ocasio-Cabo, he was a dancer and a barista. He was just 20 years old. Luis Vielma, he worked at the Harry Potter ride at Universal Orlando. He was just 22. Juan Ramon Guerrero, his cousin said Juan came out to his family just this year and was afraid they might not accept him, but they did, and they embraced his boyfriend as well. He was 22. Christopher Andrew Leonone, known as Drew, he was Juan's boyfriend, and his mom says he established the Gay-Straight Alliance at his high school. He was 32 years old. Eric Yvonne Ortiz Rivera, a friend says he was always willing to help everybody and sacrificed a lot for his family. He was 36. Peter O. Gonzalez Cruz, he worked at a UPS store, memorized apparently all the regular customers' names. He could make anyone smile, his friend said. He was just 22. Kimberly K.J. Morris moved from Hawaii to Florida just a few months ago to help her mother and her grandmother. She was a bouncer at Pulse Nightclub. She was 37. Eddie Justice was an accountant who texted his mother from the club, texted his mother saying, "Mommy, I love you." He was 30. Enrique Rios, a friend says he was cool and a funny dude who could tell people, "Don't let the world hold you back from your dreams." He was 25. Anthony Luis Laureano Dizla, a talented dancer born in Puerto Rico. He was 25. Jonathan Antonio Camuy Vega. He worked for Telemundo, first in Puerto Rico and then in Orlando. He was just about to turn 25. Corey James Connell is a student at Valencia Community College and hoped to become a firefighter. He was 21. Mercedes Marisol Flores. Her father says she was a happy girl who had so many dreams. She was 26. Dianca Deirdre Drayden, her family called her Dee Dee. She was a bartender at Pulse. She was just 32. Miguel Angel Honorato managed a Mexican restaurant. A colleague says he was an excellent boss and a good friend. He was 30. Jason Benjamin Josephat, a student at Southern Technical College where a faculty member calls him a sweet kid with a bright future. He was 19. Daryl Roman Burt II was a financial aid officer at Keiser University, was passionate about volunteer work. He was 29. Jean Carlos Mendez Perez was a perfume salesman, apparently hit the gym almost every day, and his friend said he was always happy. He was 35. Perez's longtime partner, Luis Daniel Wilson Leon, grew up in a small town in Puerto Rico and was a shoe store manager. He was 37. They died together. Frankie Jimmy De Jesus Velasquez, a professional dancer specializing in a traditional folk dance of his native Puerto Rico, he was 50. Amanda Alvear, she was a nursing student at the University of South Florida, was 25. Martin Benitez Torres, he was a college student in Puerto Rico visiting family in Orlando. He was 33. Juan Chavez Martinez, his co-workers at a hotel say he was a kind, a loving person. He was just 25. Gerald Arthur Wright worked at Disney World. The co-worker says he was wonderful with the guests. He was always smiling. He was 31. Leroy Valentin Fernandez worked leasing apartments. A co-worker says he sang Adele in the office until they couldn't take it anymore. He was 25. Tevin Eugene Crosby, dedicated, hardworking business owner from Michigan. He was just 25. Brenda Lee Marquez McCool, she had 11 kids, beat cancer twice, and often went dancing at Pulse with her gay son. She supported him that much. She was 49. Her son survived the shooting. Angel L. Candelario Padro recently moved to Orlando. He was new here. He had just started a new job as a technician at the Florida Retina Institute. He was 28. Gilberto Ramon Silva Menendez was studying healthcare management. His family says that he was the light and life of all family gatherings. He was 25. Javier Jorge Reyes was a salesman at Gucci. Friends say he was always positive. He was humble, a lovely friend. He was 40. Shane Evan Tomlinson was a gifted singer who performed at weddings and clubs. Was 33. Simone Adrian Carrillo Fernandez worked at McDonald's where he brought in birthday cakes for his co-workers and had just gotten back from a trip to Niagara Falls with his partner. He was 31. Oscar Aracena Montero was a Simon's partner. He was 26. They also died together. Rodolfa Ayala worked at a blood donation center, was a Puerto Rican native, loved to dance. He was 33 years old. Frank Hernandez, he worked at a Calvin Klein store, was a great brother and had love, had no gender tattooed on his arm. He was 27. Xavier Emmanuel Serrano Rosado was a dancer, described as hardworking and friendly, proud of his son. He was 33. Akira Monet Murray, she recently graduated from high school, was planning to go to Mercyhurst University and play basketball. She was just 18. And Christopher Joseph Sanfeliz worked at a bank, was said to be the most positive guy around, was just 24 years old. Luis Daniel Conde was a makeup artist, co-owned a salon with his partner. He was 39. Juan P. Rivera Velasquez, he was the partner to Luis. He was 37. Antonio Devon Brown was a captain in the U.S. Army Reserve and a graduate of Florida A&M. He was 29. Alejandro Barrios Martinez was 21. Joel Rayon Paniagua was 32. Jean Nieves Rodriguez was 27. We don't have pictures of these people. Ilmarie Rodriguez Sullivan was 24. And Paul Terrell Henry was 41 years old.
Our hearts go out to all of the victims, their families, and our community. And we will continue to follow this story closely and invite you to stay connected with us all week long through Facebook and Twitter. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia.
Welcome back. I want to thank Greg Moralia for putting together that special tribute to those killed in Orlando. We also want to thank CNN and Anderson Cooper. We here at Outbeat Radio think it's important we remember that this was a hate crime perpetrated on the LGBT community, most of who in this case were people of color, in a place that acted as more than a club, but as a sanctuary. There is a long history of attacks on members of our community, and they continue to this day. We are tired of lip service from our elected officials and expect action on ways in which all Americans are protected from weapons of war. We expect action on protections for all LGBT Americans in every state that will finally recognize we are not lesser or other, or should for a moment need to hide who we are. Our struggle continues. Frameline San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival celebrates its 40th year and is happening right now at venues all over San Francisco. Tickets are still available, so go to frameline.org and be a part of this exploration of queer cinema. One of the finest features this year is Retake, a stunning and unique drama that explores loss, love, and redemption. The film stars Tuck Watkins, whose brilliant career started in 1992 and has taken him from a lengthy stint on a daytime drama to a primetime hit show, and most recently to the world's biggest LGBT film festival. Thank you for joining us tonight, Tuck.
It's my pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Gary.
I can imagine that for an actor, there is almost no better feeling than finding a plum role like the one you play in Retake. Talk about how that role became yours.
Nick Corcoran reached out to me with the script, and I loved the script. Unfortunately, there was a scheduling issue. There's always a Murphy's Law when you're an actor. And you're right. It is a terrific part, and I really wanted to play the part. Scheduling didn't allow for it, so I had to decline, unfortunately. And then for one reason or another on their end, they pushed their production a little bit, so it came back together. And he came back and said, hey, are you available on these dates instead? And I said, absolutely. So it all worked out. So if everything happens for a reason, it lucked out for Tuck Watkins.
Excellent. We don't want to give away too much of the plot, which offers so many twists and turns, but describe the film to our audience.
Well, I would say it's a road trip movie. It's about a guy who something went terribly wrong in his past, and he has spent the better part of his recent past, present, and is willing to spend that time into his future to fix that problem, to set it right, to go back to that point where I think that he feels that everything went wrong and nothing in his life can go right until that wrong is righted. And so he's stuck. He's one of those guys that's stuck in the past and cannot function in the present and can't move on with his future until he works through this thing, and he goes to pretty amazing lengths to try to right that wrong.
It's a really complex character. Did you really work with Nick and other folks in the production to bring that character to life, or was that sort of your own doing?
Well, it really was pretty collaborative. One thing we were lucky to have, and that Nick afforded Devin, who is an amazing actor also, who plays the other guy in the movie, we rehearsed, and we rehearsed it like you rehearse a play. And so when we would have questions or ideas we wanted to talk about, or what is this scene really about, or can we try, I know what it says here on the page, but what if it meant, you know, something different? We got to experiment with that stuff before we had a crew around us who was waiting to go to lunch. And so I think we worked out a path that we wanted to tread when we got to set, so that when we got there, we were all sort of on the same page about how we were going to shoot it.
Great. And what was it like working with Devin Gray?
Devin's great. He approached his character. I discovered pretty early in the rehearsal process that we're both very meticulous about the way that we prep a role, and sort of with diagrams and bar graphs and intensity of one scene versus another. And, you know, our characters are obviously very different, but we approached rehearsing in a very similar way that I think we both admired and appreciated. And I felt like he came to the table having done his homework so that we could work together. And I hope that he felt the same way.
So it is a sort of a road picture. Did you film it on the road in different locations? Did you actually film here in San Francisco?
We did not shoot in San Francisco, but the movie takes place between San Francisco and the Grand Canyon. So we were in rural California most of the time. There were some hotel shoots that we did more local to Los Angeles, And if you go, you know, 10, 15 miles outside of urban Los Angeles, you run into rural desert. And a lot of what we did, a lot of what's in the movie is shot in rural Los Angeles and then out towards the Grand Canyon.
It is just a terrific film. And this is Nick's first feature. You've got an incredible amount of experience. What was it like working with a first-time director?
Well, I'll tell you, he didn't seem like a first-time director. And you know, when you're older than the director, you can't help but think, "Oh boy, I hope this guy knows stuff." And Nick has a quiet confidence about him that I really admire in people that I work with, whether they're actors or directors or writers. And he seemed to be very sure of what he was doing. And there were a few times where I would say, I would suggest something. I would suggest a particular way to go in one scene, which would lead to another. And he would entertain it, and he would consider it. And more often than not, we came back to his vision. Which I think is a real testament to him. And in the long run, I think he was usually right. So I was very impressed by what he did. And I saw his short Barbie Boy, and I loved it. And I thought, I want to work with the guy that did that.
That's
and he used the same person who did the music for Barbie Boy did the music for Retake, and the music in Retake is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
And the editor is another character in the movie, you know, a guy that I had met, you know, during pre-production, but, you know, who I didn't interact with. And he did an amazing job. There are a few times where I like to try to, if we have time, I like to try sort of a spectrum on a particular scene where I don't necessarily think that it's going to work, but it's nice to try something really understated and then really overstated. And the truth is usually somewhere in the middle. And there were a few times where I think I went way too far afield. And after I saw the screen of the movie, I went up to the editor and I said, "Thank you for saving me from myself." Because the takes that you took across the film to make your through lines really worked well. And that's, I'm sure Nick was over his shoulder doing that, but these guys are really talented people.
It really shows on the screen. Again, it's just an amazing film. I think it's one of the best of Frameline this year.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Will this be your first time at Frameline as an audience member or as a guest?
Yes, it will. They're doing a couple screenings, and I'm going to be... Nick and I are both from Kansas City, coincidentally. I don't think I realized he was from Kansas City until we were rehearsing.
Wow.
I'm in Kansas City right now because that's where I'm from. And I brought my kids here to spend time with relatives and go to the lake, et cetera, et cetera. And it coincides with the Kansas City Gay and Lesbian Film Festival where it's playing. So I'm going to be here for that. And then I'm going to come to the second screening in San Francisco on June 25th.
Saturday. So there's a screening at the screening at the Castro Tuesday, for you listening out there, because you really need to see this film. Screening at the Castro Tuesday, and then at the Victoria Theater Saturday. Great.
Yes. So I think Nick and Paul, the director of photography, who also did an amazing job, and Sean Mandel, who is a young producer, but we're going to see a lot more from him. They're all going to be at the initial screening. I think it's on the 24th in San Francisco. Then they're coming here to Kansas City, and then we'll all be back in San Francisco for Saturday the 25th.
Perfect, perfect. So let's go back in time a bit. I know you're on One Life to Live, playing narcissistic cad David Vickers.
My days and nights of David Vickers on One Life to Live. That was, what a great character. David Vickers was my Hamlet. Most actors want to play Hamlet. I loved playing David Vickers, the bumbling con man in Landview, Pennsylvania, who was a threat to no one. And he hatched plans and stole diamonds and right. Married the wrong people. And, you know, when I first started on that show in 1994, I was hired to play a mysterious, cool con man. And I did that for about a year, but I did it pretty unremarkably, to tell you the truth. And there were a lot more people who were more qualified at doing that kind of stock soap opera character.
Right.
And, you know, on a soap like that, there's a tapestry of characters. And each person needs to be pretty unique. Otherwise, when you start blending in with others, you are dispensable. And I didn't want to be dispensed with. So one day I accidentally fell down the stairs during the take, and everybody laughed. And I was humiliated, obviously. But that's when it kind of clicked for me that David Vickers is not a cool, mysterious con man. He thinks he's a cool, mysterious con man. And that's when David Vickers came to be the guy that we know, love, or hate for the next on and off 18 years.
Wow. That is quite a stint. And then you went to Desperate Housewives. Tell us about what it was like to be on a hit network show.
Well, it's always fun to work on a juggernaut every now and then. And I remember reading for it, and every now and then a director or producer will tell you why you got a part. And actors, it's never a smart idea to ask that question because the answer is rarely fulfilling. But Mark Cherry said, "Well, you know why you got this job?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I was a big fan of Beggars and Choosers, which was this series on Showtime about maybe 8 or 10 years prior." Mm-hmm. He said, I've just been waiting to hire you as one of the gay guys on Desperate Housewives, which I knew I would eventually have a gay couple on Desperate Housewives. I wanted you to play that part. So, you know, it's too bad I wasn't told that 8 years prior to know that I had the confidence and the foresight to know that 8 years down the road, 8 years down the road, I'm going to have this plum part on a hit ABC show. But so he brought me on as the tall gay guy and Kevin Rahm on as the funny gay guy. And we lived between Eva Longoria and Terry Hatcher for 4 or 5 years.
Nice, nice. The Beggars and Choosers was just an incredible show. It was
awesome. Oh, did you see that? Yes. That really was a good show. That was,
yeah.
That was right before Showtime, I think, really hit its stride with a lot of terrific series.
Right.
And so we were up in Vancouver shooting a TV show about Los Angeles. There was even a scene where we had to use real snow in Vancouver to pretend to be fake snow in Los Angeles, pretending to be real snow in Canada. So
<That's>
it was
great.
Pretty convoluted, but it was a really well-written show by Peter Lefcourt, who's a novelist. And it was the last project that Brandon Tartikoff ushered in before he passed.
Hmm. Yeah, wow. I never put that together. Did you fear that playing gay would negatively impact your career at the time?
You know, I got to say yes. You know, we actors, we just want to play different parts. We want to be ciphers. We want to, we don't want people to know too much about us so that when we do play, you know, a hunchback or a bus driver or the head of a network, that it's just that much more believable. Mm-hmm. And there really was a stigma for a long, long time about playing gay parts or being a gay actor playing gay parts. And the truth is, when a good part comes along, you just can't help but want to play it. And I've played several gay parts in my career and several straight parts in my career. And some of the best ones have been the gay characters. Mm. And Malcolm Laffey on Beggars and Choosers was one of those. And that was one of the, I'd say, last issue-oriented gay roles that I played, where the issue was coming out. Mm. Or other issues are, you know, being affected by HIV/AIDS or, you know, dealing with your family not accepting you.
Right.
And that's what most gay parts were for a long time. But fortunately, with, you know, the progression of, you know, any minority that comes into the zeitgeist, we get to be fuller characters and play fuller characters. And I think it's been really nice seeing that evolution.
Excellent. And then you finally did come out very publicly on the Marie Osmond show. In 2013.
Yes, me and Marie Osmond. Yeah, it was shortly after I had kids by surrogate.
Hmm.
After I came out the other end of my midlife crisis, the one thing that I was really left with was that I was really ready to be a dad.
Hmm.
And so I moved heaven and earth to do that. And through the surrogacy process, I have a son and a daughter who are now 3.5 years old, and they are amazing and a handful and everything I wanted and then some.
Wow. So what can we see you in next?
Well, let's see. I worked on Ballers that I think that starts airing this summer.
Oh.
I'm working on a pilot with some friends right now about it's a comedy about some horrible people, but along the lines of Seinfeld, all the funny people tend to be bad people,
right?
In a funny way. So hopefully we're going to camera on that later this summer, and so we'll see what Retake does.
Big things, I bet. Tuck, we want to thank you for appearing on Output Radio.
It's my pleasure, Gary. It's nice talking to you.
During his illustrious 40-year career, Bob Hawke has acted as curator, consultant, mentor, and producer, but until now remained mostly behind the independent film scenes. Film Hawke, the documentary that celebrates his life, enjoyed its premiere last night at Frameline 40 at the historic Castro Theater. Bob, thank you very much for joining us on Output Radio.
Hi.
Tell us a bit about how this great documentary came to be.
Well, it grew like a mushroom or something, I don't know. Actually, the filmmakers, J.J. Garvine and Ty Parquet, I was a consultant on their film, a documentary called Keeping the Peace that was over 10 years ago. I am a consultant for independent filmmakers and an occasional producer. Anyway, their doc, Keeping the Peace, is used to this day by peace organizations. 5 years ago, they approached me. They said, Bob, you're an interesting figure in the independent film community. We want to interview and make a short film of you, just talking. And that's how it all began. And I said, really? And I said, well, okay. And it grew and grew and grew. And they began to want to interview people that have been part of my life, both in indie film, two members of my family, and then, of course, LGBT film. I've been gay for as long as I can remember. And so the film, inevitably, I don't just talk about my career. I talk about my life, as you know, because you've seen the film.
Yes.
And it just grew and grew and grew. And I trusted the filmmakers, because I did know them, and I talked uncensored, unfiltered. I trusted them to choose what stories out of my life they wanted to tell, and I was not worried about, you know, that they'd do me wrong, and I'm very happy. I cannot be objective about looking at myself, but I'm very happy with the way it's turned out. And as I saw different cuts, the only thing I was concerned about was length. I said, tighten it up. Keep it short. Less is more.
Right, right. So you were right there making suggestions and helping them shape the film?
Well, it was kind of... I was periodically there. They're from Wilmington, Delaware, and I'm from New York City, and they came up to shoot in New York, but it was over 3.5 years that this film was in the making. And of course, with the internet and with Vimeo and everything, they were able to send me cuts. But
right.
But I wanted them to make the film, and as I said, I could not be objective, but I can be objective about length. I've consulted on hundreds and hundreds of films, and an awful lot of them could stand to be tightened.
Talk a bit about how you got to this point, and I'm going to ask you about Word Is Out specifically, because I think that's a nice starting point. Mm-hmm. But talk about what brought you to that point in 1977, your sort of education and your background, and, you know, mm-hmm. how you became so interested in film, and specifically what we call smaller films, independent films, whatever term we may use now, because it's sort of shifted.
In the film, it was established that I had a speech impediment, and I found out when I acted on stage, I didn't stutter. So I was all theater. I love movies from, you know, childhood, but it was always out there. It was Hollywood, you know. I didn't know anything about underground or independent film or anything. So I was devoted to theater into my adult life, not as an actor. I wanted to work behind the scenes. And I was a techie off Broadway in the 60s, and then I became a stage manager. By the way, in the late 60s, early 70s, I did 4 shows out of New York in San Francisco as a stage manager. But in 76, mid-year, I went to a five and a half hour, very rough cut. It was basically an assembly of Word Is Out. It was in a Congregational church in North Beach. At that time, I was taking a break from stage managing. I was a dishwasher in a restaurant just to pay the rent. I was volunteering for the Anti-Briggs Initiative. I was very active in gay activism, so to
right,
speak.
Right.
So, anyway, but I went to this work in progress, and the film, Word Is Out, it was made by a collective that traveled all over the U.S. and filmed gay people of all genders, persuasions, ethnicities, and ages. And it's a seminal film. It was really the first film that did this. And it was made by a collective founded by Peter Adair. And there were 6 in the collective. And the youngest one, he was 19 or 20, was Rob Epstein.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Anyway, I had the time, because I was not working in theater right then, and I was in San Francisco. I'm East Coast based, but I chose to live in San Francisco because Anita Bryant was acting up, and
right.
and an awful lot of people were migrating to San Francisco at that time. The Castro had been a sleepy Irish neighborhood before then, and, you know,
right.
And it was just that period, you know, where you just felt very motivated to be somewhere where you could really be gay and be supportive of other people.
Right.
So anyway, after I got involved with Word Is Out, they just invited me to follow up screenings, you know, because I wrote what Rob refers to as a thesis. I was just so amazed at this film and its potential. So anyway, but I also began to see other independent films. And I saw a lot of narrative features that were shot before the script was developed, before it was really ready. And in the theater, you have 4 to 6 weeks of rehearsals, you have previews, then you open, and you do it 8 times a week. And so I felt very grounded in storytelling, in dramaturgy. And I felt that I had something to offer independent filmmakers. And so I began to consult on other films after word is out. And it was very informal, you know. And then in 78, Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone were assassinated. And I was living here at that time. And by that time, I had gotten to know Rob Epstein as a friend. And Rob, I thought, whoa, this is a story that would make a great documentary. And I thought he had the sensibilities, the sensitivities to make this film. And I helped him, because I'm a good copy editor, too. I helped him hammer out his first grant proposals, things like that. And it took 5 years before Harvey Milk, the Times of Harvey Milk, went into production in 83. And at that time, I started working on the film as a researcher, print media researcher, and I developed an archive of over 600 articles. So I became the print media researcher and archivist for the Times of Harvey Milk. I collected over 600 articles, and I broke them down into 20 topics. And those files were used before they interviewed people to, you know, research and prepare. And then the actual clippings, some of them were used visually in the film. And also I created a chronology for the editors because I knew the chronology and they were confused. So I helped them, you know. Anyway, and so the Times of Harvey Milk, which went on to win an Academy Award, and it is known as the first gay Academy Award.
Right.
The nonprofit fiscal sponsor was the Film Arts Foundation in San Francisco, which was a nonprofit for independent film and video makers of Northern California, from Big Sur to the Oregon border. And I began to volunteer. I got to know them, and I began to take some of my time off. And I got to know the organization well enough to know that they really needed a bigger outreach and exhibition component. And I conceived the Film Arts Festival, which was a showcase of the constituents' films and videos. And the festival itself ran for 21 years, and I was its director for the first 8 years. And it gave me an opportunity to do outreach at Sundance Film Festival, at the Berlin Film Festival, at the New York Independent Feature Film Market, and it was my way of getting to know people from all over the world, and I was promoting the Bay Area, the talent here.
Right, the immense talent.
So that's how I kind of evolved beyond just local into national and then international.
Excellent. This is a milestone year for Frameline. What does the festival mean to you, and how does it feel to have a film about your life and work screened at the Castro?
Well, first off, to have a film about me at all, I still find it hard to believe it exists. I've seen it, but I just am rather flabbergasted, and certainly I feel there are other people who subjectively I feel are more worthy, but they've made it and people like it. And so to be in Frameline is probably, well, to be at the Castro Theater, which I also worked for the Castro Theater at one period in my life. And I have so many memories in the Castro wearing various hats. And that beautiful movie palace and that big screen is going to be something else. Frameline is very meaningful to me also. I first attended the second edition of Frameline. So I've been attending for 39 years. And I've only missed 2 years. This is my 37th festival, wow. But I had to miss it 2 years over that long period of time. Anyway, I have played many roles at Frameline. I was on their board of directors. I was on their screening committee. I was on various committees, and I was involved in the actual operations of the festival when it was going on. I actually got time off from Film Arts Foundation with pay in order to use my talents as a stage manager and a house manager to be a liaison between Frameline and the Castro staff.
Nice, nice.
So, obviously, I have tons of memories involving all of these elements. So it's just so thrilling that I can hardly stand it.
Bob, again, thank you for joining us. Best of luck with everything, and we're thrilled to have you back here in the Bay Area with us.
Well, it's always great to be back, and I come back every year.
Our final guest tonight is Shalice Haas, whose documentary Real Boy follows a 19-year-old musician during his transition from female to male. The film debuted this afternoon at Frameline and will be screened again in the East Bay Thursday. Shalice, thank you for joining us tonight on Outbeat Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations on Real Boy and getting into Frameline.
Thank you.
So talk about what that means as a filmmaker to get into such a prestigious film festival.
Sure. Well, I have a longtime Bay Area resident. I grew up in the Bay Area, and I've been in the East Bay almost 12 years, and have loved the Frameline Film Festival as an attendee of the festival, and have also really appreciated the curation in the festival for speaking to queer audiences and bringing films that we don't see anywhere else, or maybe that that we see here first.
Mm-hmm.
But also really to they know their audience really well and understand that the LGBT audiences here in the Bay Area are really savvy and interested in complex, nuanced, diverse stories. And so to be included in that lineup is really an honor.
Hmm. How did you meet Bennett and come to decide that you wanted to make a film about his journey?
I met Bennett through his mentor, Joe Stevens, who is an older than Bennett, trans musician who had been part of a band called Coyote Grace. And I was a fan of Coyote Grace's music, and I had met Joe through friends of mine and was at a house concert at Joe's house, and he had just met Bennett. They had met at a conference for sober youth and had bonded over a lot of shared experience, and Bennett was there to open this house concert, and I just really appreciated his music. He had great lyrics. He was really engaging and charming. He was also really nervous, and he was at a moment where it was pretty clear he was at the beginning of a journey, not just in his transition, but really in just arriving at young adulthood. And he was having a lot of difficulty with his family. And I was moved by the relationship between Bennett and Joe. There was a particular quality to their relationship. You know, there was certainly mentorship there, but there was a lot of mirroring. There was a lot of, you know, there was so much that they had in common.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the role of mentorship and by extension, the role of chosen family is so important in our queer communities that I was really interested in the way that that was kind of showing up in their lives. And so I was intrigued by that and asked them if I could film with them. And they both were very open to it. And then as the film continued, the story expanded to include Bennett's family of origin, his mom in particular, who became a pretty major part of the film.
So she wasn't necessarily on board from the beginning?
She wasn't. In fact, I initially, after I'd met Bennett, asked if I could come down to L.A. and interview him, and he said, sure, and he invited me to come down. He was staying at his mom's house, and he said, well, my mom won't be there, so you can come down and talk, you know, we can have the whole house to ourselves and we can set up this interview. I said, okay, great. And I came down and I got there, and like a couple hours after I arrived, Bennett's mom came home to find me there filming. And he hadn't told her. And so it was a slightly awkward moment, but over the course of that weekend that I was there, she let me talk to her a little bit, although she was a little bit unsure about what was happening. And then we developed a relationship over the subsequent year, and then the film took 4 years to make. So the relationship with Susie Bennett's mom was one that that I built over a longer period of time, and,
wow.
and she ultimately became very involved and comfortable with the filmmaking, but that certainly wasn't the case on day one.
Interesting, because she's such an important part of the film.
Yeah.
So you said it took 4 years to film?
Correct, yeah. And so when we meet Bennett, he's 19, and when the film ends, he's 23. And so we filmed, most of the film takes place in the first year, but the sort of latter third of the film is follows Bennett and his relationship with his mom and his best friend and his mentor sort of over those 4 years.
Right.
Those relationships evolve.
I was thinking how wonderful for you as a filmmaker to have a built-in soundtrack. Two talented musicians right there.
Music and Joe's music certainly are a big part of the soundtrack of the film. We also did have a phenomenal composer, William Ryan Fritch, who is also a California musician, and he was amazing. So it's both scored and there's a lot of their music in the film.
Yes, I've interviewed Joe on this show.
Oh, wonderful!
So he's a fascinating person. Again, we don't want to give too much of the story away, but talk a little bit more about Joe Stevens' involvement in the film.
Sure. So Joe, part of how the film started is that I had been reading Joe's blog, and he's a phenomenal musician. He's a tremendous instrumentalist, but also his lyrics and his songwriting are really amazing. And he's also a great writer. And so he has written quite a bit in his blog about his experience of addiction and recovery, and I had been reading it, and he's very candid about his experience with addiction, and so it's a part of the film that we followed And so I feel like there's a way in which he gave a tremendous amount of himself, not only in the film as a mentor to Bennett, as an older, you know, someone who had transitioned, you know, 10 years before, but who was really also figuring out how to be both a mentor to a younger person who he saw as very much a reflection of his own life, but also what it meant to be a, you know, at the time when we first started filming, he was sort of a recently sober and trying to find his voice again as a songwriter. And so he's a pretty amazing person and a lot of complexity to his story as well.
And being sober is such an important part of Bennett's life also. Which you touched on in a very interesting way, because Bennett, like you said, when you started filming was 19 years old. So, it's difficult for some people to imagine that people could sort of have it together at that age to realize, oh, I've got a problem with drugs and or alcohol, and I need to get on this different path. Was that something you really delved into research-wise or with Bennett and with Joe?
Well, this film very much is a, you know, it's a very personal film, and the story is that it stays within the sort of confines of the world of its characters, right? So it's not a film that that I would call an issue film. So in many ways, we didn't sort of bring in outside experts or other things, and so the experts on in this story are the people in it, right? And so, I mean, I think these are issues that for Bennett and Joe, they each have a very personal relationship with. And I think it's true when it comes to addiction and recovery. It's true when it comes to, you know, gender, sexuality, any other piece of this, is that it's all very deeply personal. And it's not meant to represent anybody else or any other group. And the story is very much filtered through my own lens as a director, as a queer, cisgendered woman. You know, so in many ways, the film is a product both of their real lives, but also the things that I found interesting or found resonant for myself that that I think are part of the film as well.
Right, right. Yeah. Again, without giving too much away, what surprised you most during either filming or editing, or what really struck you during this process?
I'm so grateful for the opportunity to make the film, and I'm very close with Bennett and Joe and Susie. And because it took 4 years, there were so many ups and downs. There were so many moments when I thought, this is the best, you know, this is amazing, best idea ever. And then there were other times when I thought, this is the worst idea ever. I don't know why I'm, you know, this film is never going to get finished. It's not going to get funded, or we're going to find in the edit that there's no story here. Who's going to want to see this? So I think the emotional journey of making a film was such a roller coaster.
For those folks who are unable to see Real Boy at Frameline, will they have an opportunity to see it anytime in the future?
Yes. Well, we are in festivals around the world, actually, right now, and will be throughout the rest of the year and probably into the next year. And we will also be having a broadcast in 2017 on PBS, and that information will all be on our website, realboymovie.com. But we will have, once it's on public television, it will be available both on TV, but also for a period of time online for people to see it.
Wonderful, wonderful. What's up next for you?
Outside of bringing the Real Boy to audiences.
Right. Are you on to the next project, or you're still engrossed in
sure.
this?
Sure. So I am currently sort of in conversations with a few people and thinking about the next project. I think the next project for me is going to be one where I am more of an auntie to a film rather than giving birth to it, in the sense that I'm interested in being a creative producer on somebody else's project and bringing some of my resources and skills to bear on helping another project come to life.
That's great.
And I also teach. So I'm doing both
where do you teach?
I teach, right now I'm teaching at UC Berkeley in their undergraduate department, and I have also teach for workshops for mid-career journalists and other adults at the Berkeley Advanced Media Institute.
Nice, nice. Well, Shalice, again, congratulations on your achievement, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We want to thank all our guests tonight, not just Tuck, but Bob Hawk and Shalice Haas. And we really thank you for joining us tonight to discuss Frameline and to let our listeners know exactly what's going on in San Francisco this week at this incredible 40th annual film festival that celebrates LGBT films. Greg Moralia will be back next Sunday with a special Pride episode of Outbeat News in Depth. Mary McHale and I will be back next month. Please look to outbeatradio.com for past shows and more information about what's happening, not just here on Outbeat Radio, but around our community. Again, thank you for listening. Happy Pride. Be safe. Be sane. And remember, the struggle continues.